Once again, let's welcome Carolina De Robertis and Mika Perks.
Thanks for staying.
And the microphone rule is for questions, just ask and we'll come here with the microphone. So you can be recorded. The question can be recorded. Okay. Questions from the audience?
You said, Carolina, you said you did it in a stream of consciousness style for your novel, how it the narration transitions from person to person through chapters. What made you want to write in that format?
Wow, that was loud. Well, some of the segments are in stream of consciousness, and I happen to read some things that kind of sound pretty interior, heavy interior monologue, but there is a lot of scene in the book as well, scene and more traditional dialogue. There's a mix. Is it about the shift in point of view from one character to another, or about being more interior into people's thoughts?
I'd say more so the interior.
Yeah.
Like a lot of it's externalizing the dialogue that they show to other people, but I still get that vibe from it.
Sort of a stream of consciousness, we hear a lot from within people kind of vibe from this book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, for me, this is one of the things I talk about a lot in workshop with students, is that form follows content, or form mirrors content a lot of the time. So, when a form really works for a novel, the way I think of it, it should in some way kind of reflect what the content is, what the theme is, what the message is of your book. And you don't always know consciously when you're working on it. Sometimes we just know that we sort of need these short chapters because it makes sense. And then later you might realize that reflects maybe sort of the fragmentation in the person's life, to give you an example. In this case, I knew pretty early on that part of this journey was very much an interior journey. Leda does very outward dramatic things. She passes as a man. She has, many sexual encounters. She lives as a musician. There are dramatic moments in the plot. But at the same time, this was also very much a story about coming to terms with the dazzling inner universe that a person has, and the ways in which that universe inside is in no way reflected in the outer world that that person is in. And so that really called for a lot of interiority. And so there's a lot of sort of internal reflection, and that felt like it was necessary to me in order to fully do justice to the character. And to other characters, because if you look at, for example, just the example of this sex worker who had been trafficked, she says very little to people around her. And that's a very real and realistic thing that a sex trafficked young woman might do. But I didn't want to shortchange the rich interiority that she also has, the vast inner life that a person like that might have, which is an inner life that is, I think, very invisible to our mainstream culture. And I think fiction has an incredible opportunity to delve into the consciousness of people. We can delve into the skin of other people through fiction in a way that no other artistic medium is equally primed to do.
Hi. So my question is kind of like a little bit about identity, and like, because you have a lot of like different voices in your book, and I was just thinking, do you think your identity is reflected in this book? Because I feel like you brought a lot of like the Argentino or Afro-Argentino, and then the Polish girl who ends up just speaking Spanish, and then Layla going through this like transformation of like, using like a male identity to be able to like do what she wants. So I kind of feel like a little bit, I don't know, like just like identity is a really big theme in the book.
So yes, I think you're right that identity is a big theme in the book. And it sounds like you have a question about the extent to which those identities are reflective of my own, or how much I put of myself into
yes.
the book. Yeah. So I think we use what we have within us when we write fictional characters, and Mika, you may want to chime in on that theme as well. And sometimes we might use things that are within us to describe the inner life of a character that doesn't have the same identities as us. Certainly, we might have someone who's grieving a very different life circumstance than we've ever had, has demographic identities that are very different from our own, but we can dig within ourselves to find the seeds of grief to be able to imagine what it might be like to be in their shoes. At some point in writing fiction, unless we write extremely autobiographical fiction, we do have to imagine ourselves into the skins of people who aren't like us. Like, for example, Santiago is a black man in early 20th century Buenos Aires, and heterosexual. These are all things that I'm not. And then I think when we do write identities that are not the same as our own, especially when they are identities that are historically marginalized around an identity line where we have privilege, I think it's really important to do as much homework as we possibly can, and also get expert readers whenever possible to help support the process of finding the places where you've had your own blinders and kind of go deeper. So that's something that's been part of my process. As far as the personal piece, yes, I mean, I think I put a lot of my own personal story into this story, even though I haven't done all the things that Leda's done. I just don't have the physique to pass as a man, to be perfectly frank, or else I might have had a different life. But I have, you know, I haven't had the same trajectory as Leda, but there are things within her process of becoming herself that were really, really urgent themes for me to give voice to, and I didn't realize how true that was until the book was out in the world, and I felt more vulnerable and raw than I had with any of my prior books, and I really realized that I had put a lot of my own raw self into her journey. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Yeah.
How about you?
I think it's interesting how maybe, and sometimes when you're writing, or at least when I'm writing, I almost hide from myself the elements of my book that are autobiographical. And then it wasn't really until my book just came out a couple weeks ago, and someone was interviewing me, and I realized my main character, Evie, has twins inside of her, and then she's also kind of haunted by this character, Mary Rowlandson, and she's also a teacher, so there's all these kids around her. And I realized that there was this period, a long period of my life, where I had had two children, and I got together with a man who also had two children, and so suddenly everything was doubled. And I really felt thronged by people. I feel like and also I think, mm-hmm, that idea of twins as being a doubled self too. And so I think maybe subconsciously I was writing out of that moment.
But I
definitely didn't think of that consciously. I imagine that Evie was someone different from me, you know, and was having an experience very different than mine. So yeah.
I'm just going to refer that real quickly. I think you said personal urgency. I mean, I think that you weren't conscious of it.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting because sometimes we're not fully conscious of what is urgent about the thing or why we're so interested in this story that's reaching the page that might in concrete ways seem different from our own. And yet there's something underneath that we're working out. And I think that can be true. And I think personal urgency is really important, even if it is a story that's not exactly like your own. I mean, even the example of Afro-Argentines and the character of Santiago, you know, I am not black, I'm not of African descent, but I'm married to a black woman, my children are multiracial and Afro-Latino, and I have a really deep, deep vested stake in seeing my countries of origin address and undo their racism, mm-hmm, and look deeply at that history. And I think for me that's been a very urgent thing that's starting to come out in that fiction. That doesn't mean that I, you know, don't have blinders around race and don't need to do all of that deep work as a writer. I think that's all still true.
Yeah.
But I do think there's a personal urgency there for me, even though it's not my identity. There's something about writing those identities and making sure they're in the book that feels extremely urgent to me personally.
Hmm. I'm really interested in, Carolina, in your work regarding marginalized groups in a historical context, especially the queer and Afro-Latino perspective, point of view, characters in the past, and what kind of advice would you give a person of color writer or Latino writer on how to also access that, because like you bring up in Gods of Tango is, you know, Latin America is very rich. There's Afro-Latinos everywhere. There's Afro-Latinos in Mexico, and that narrative is constantly erased. And so what advice would you give for someone who wants to do something similar or is in the process of doing that? And what was your process?
I'm so glad you brought that up, Renee. And I think, you know, writing stories in a historical context that are marginalized often means that there's less material. And so that was certainly the case for me here. Just last night I presented at the San Francisco Public Library and someone said, you know, well, did you find a lot of information on queer people, gay people in Buenos Aires at the time? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. That doesn't mean that there weren't gay people or genderqueer people. Of course it doesn't mean that. It means that there was no documentation. Also, with the tango, it didn't start to get documented until after 1913, when it started to be on the sort of aristocratic side of town. And so before that, these tremendous contributions of Afro-Argentines, it was extremely under-documented. And so you work with what you can find. I think digging and finding materials, sometimes the materials are there, but they haven't been given as much space and light by scholars or by the mainstream, certainly. And so you have to just keep digging. And then you can find materials. And then I think in instances where the materials are not fully present, I think that then it is also a matter of really taking that imaginative leap all the way in. I personally believe that fiction has an incredible power to fill the silences of history. There are things that scholars will never be able to get, you know, documentation of what it was like to be Black and Mexican and gay in 1800s. We're never going to get that voice on a sort of documented scholarly level. But we could get those things through fiction. One of the giants I always carry around very gratefully in my mind is Toni Morrison, whose entire life project has been to write into the silences of U.S. American history, specifically the silences with regard to, of course, Black people in the United States. And one of the images she has written about is that history is like a riverbed that's gone dry, where the water has been rerouted and stolen out of it, and that through the act of fictionalizing and through the act of imagination, we can fill the water, fill the bed with water again, fill the riverbed with water again. And I would encourage any Latino writers wanting to do that work to really hold that kind of an image, that the bed is empty and we can refill it with water, that we can fill those vacuums and those silences with voice. And I personally believe that to be very needed work.
My question is for Mika. I'm curious about this idea of having your narrators be unborn twin fetuses. I'm wondering, first of all, just if you can pinpoint some sort of like where the decision came from, the inspiration, yeah. But also just if there were any challenges from like in the language you used or in how did you go about deciding how to like create a point of view for people who haven't even been born yet.
Yeah, those are great questions. Okay, so when I first started writing my novel, I really wanted to have a kind of like a big storytelling voice, but I didn't want it to be like a once upon a time anonymous third person. I wanted it to be an actual character, and I was trying to figure out how to do that, and I hit on the idea. Well, first of all, I should say Carlos Fuentes has a novel called Christopher Unborn that he published in 1987, and it's narrated by a fetus. So I'm definitely not the first person to do that. But in any case, and there's some other people who have done it too. Yes, Tristram Shandy, who wasn't exactly a fetus, but he seems to have known his conception. Yeah, exactly. And Ian McEwan just published a novel also not narrated by a fetus. So in any case, I liked the idea. I kind of feel like a fetus is in some ways, this might sound weird, but in some ways, the relationship of author to character is sort of like a fetus, because you're inside, the author is inside the character, they're inside their own characters, and yet they don't, if it's going well, you don't really have control, or you allow the character to take control of the narrative, and just, you're kind of watching and narrating when it's going well. And that's sort of like a fetus, you know, you're inside, but you're inside the mother, but you have no control. You're just kind of narrating, or they would be narrating if they had any consciousness like that. So I guess that's where it came from. Then I wrote the whole novel out with a single fetus telling the story. The voice is kind of ripped off like a kind of 19th century Walt Whitman-esque voice. It's a kind of a poetic voice that the fetus has, a kind of utopian, I contain multitudes kind of voice. Mm-hmm. So I wrote the whole book out. My agent couldn't sell it. And everyone said it was too weird. So then, kind of in desperation, I rewrote it took me 10 years to write this book. So then for over another long period, I rewrote it to try to make it more unobjectionable, you know, and to make it sell to so someone would buy it. And I took out the fetal voice and I just had a third person narrative. I basically took out Mary Rowlandson. I tried just to make it this really normal book. And then I showed it to my writing group and they basically hated it. You know, there was, you know, that moment when you're in workshop and there's just this like silence and you can just tell everybody hates us, and they're trying to be polite and supportive, like, oh, if you just didn't, but you know, change the whole thing. If you just change this entire book. I remember one person saying very meekly, I miss the old book, you know? So I went home, I cried, I said, I hate those people, they don't know what they're talking about. But then after a couple weeks, I started thinking about, like, why did I write this book in the first place? Like, what was the point? And I realized that I really loved that voice. Like, I really wanted, that was what attracted me, to try to write in that voice. And so then I just said, screw it, I'm gonna double it. So I rewrote it with twins. And then, and also it turned out to be real, it worked really well for the book, because the book is a lot about, and basically I grew up on a commune, and so a lot of, basically all my work, all my three books are about that kind of utopian impulse, and both the like intense desire to be connected to other people and to be almost like one person, and also the intense claustrophobia of that feels like, and wanting to escape and get away from that kind of close relationship. So the twins were kind of perfect for that, because they almost are the same person, and yet as they are growing, they're taking up more space. It's harder and harder to share that same space in a lot of ways in the same way that in the 17th century, the Native people and the British colonialists were trying to share the same space, and that didn't work out that well. So yeah. Does that answer it? Yeah, thanks for that question. It's a great one.
Kind of two-part question for both of you. I'm thinking about scholars that have worked in these areas in each case, and Robert Ferris Thompson has done all that work on the origins of the tango, mm-hmm. and the African origins of the tango and so forth, and amazing scholar and Africanist and so forth.
Yes, I am pro the Robert Ferris Thompson tango art history of love. Not yeah. everyone is. There are tango people who really disdain it. Yes, he exaggerates the black roots.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's a great book.
Yeah, and then as regards Mika's work on Mary Rowlandson, like I read Mary Rowlandson only through Susan Howe,
yes.
like 25 years ago or something,
yes.
whenever her work on that came out.
Brilliant.
And I'm just wondering about how this scholarly work might have come into the fiction, or is playing in some manner in the fiction for both of you.
Yeah. I thank Susan Howe in my book. Susan Howe, have any of you read Susan Howe? She's a poet, but also a literary critic. But and her criticism is very lyrical, almost poetic. And she wrote a piece about Mary Rowlandson. It's in what's it called? Something the Wilderness. Anyway, it's half the book is about Mary Rowlandson. And it's beautiful, and it really did had a really strong effect on me. But I also, you know, I did a ton of research. Jill Lepore wrote about Mary Rowlandson. Susan Faludi writes about Mary Rowlandson. A lot of people, Elaine Showalter, a lot of feminist writers have written about her. It really did have a strong effect on me, and on the way I thought about. Who she was, kind of like being in conversation. You know, when you read things that you like, and you're sort of writing back to them, like in conversation with them, thinking like, oh, I don't agree with that, but I do agree with this, and
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, God bless scholars. I feel like I draw on their work so much, and that's a huge part of my work so far. My novels have all had a historical underpinning, and I research a book for at least a year before I start writing. But that's a joyful part of it for me, too. I'm sort of discovering the world that I know I want the book to be set in and what's going to be in that world, because that's all also going to form and shape what it is that my characters will experience. And so then from that soup of research discovery kind of arises the plot, the narrative tension, the characters themselves, their inner worlds. The Robert Ferris Thompson book was one of the first books, because it's more well known, that I read that sort of acknowledged the Black roots. Juan Carlos Cáceres is a really important musician who wrote a book about Tango Negro. It hasn't been translated into English, but another really important text as far as the piece of really affirming the Afro-Argentine contribution to the tango. But I read a lot of scholarly texts and then also on other things, like I couldn't find examples of people passing as male in Buenos Aires at the time, but the biography of Billy Tipton by Diane Wood Middlebrook was really important. So Billy Tipton was a jazz musician who passed as male for 50 years in the United States and then died at the age of 73, and people took the corpse's clothes off and discovered that this person was biologically female, had had three marriages, raised two kids who knew they were adopted but had no idea that their dad was biologically female. And his first wife, you know, was interviewed by the biographer and said, I absolutely had no idea. I had pregnancy scares in my marriage because I didn't want to have a baby and I thought I was pregnant. And reading that, I'm so grateful I got to that book early on, because that made me realize that I was actually holding back, you know, in what I was describing as possible in my character's life. So, you know, that's just one example, but, you know, I went through a lot of different texts. And then there's also, in Argentina and Uruguay, there are so many texts, and Argentina is sort of famous for having these bookstores that are open all night, and, you know, late night forays with my cousins into bookstores, and sort of dog-eared out of print little books about the tango, and just collecting them. So on a lot of levels, I'm super grateful to scholars. And then I also had a couple scholars read the book as well, a musicologist, a tango violinist, which was great.
That sounds so fun.
Having them read the book?
Just the whole research? And no.
It is fun,
research,
right? Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sound fun. People are like, oh, it's a lot of research. But it is fun. I find it really exhilarating. And then there's also the research that I kind of think of it as, if you've heard of method acting, I kind of think of it as method noveling. Which is really kind of getting in the skin of it. So like, as novelists, we research the way scholars do, but we also research with our bodies. So there's also that talk about fun, right? I took violin lessons to really get a corporeal sense of that relationship to that instrument, which totally transformed how I could write about it. I took dance lessons in Uruguay with a longtime Uruguayan tango dancer. I walked the streets of Buenos Aires and just tried to like get a sense of the texture of the air and the smells, and you know, all those little antique shops in San Telmo that have like, you know, like a little button from 1920, and you're like, oh, maybe that's the brooch that this character wears in that moment. Like everything can spark, and it all kind of goes in the pot. So yeah, the method noveling is fun.
That's a good name for it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
One more question.
I have a question more about the Orlando poem. I was just wondering, like, what are some of the difficulties that you, like, encounter when translating your works? Because I'm, like, kind of interested in that, but I'm not sure, like, what the process is or, like, what kind of things you encounter with translation, just because it is kind of, like, two different worlds with two different languages. Kind of enter like two different worlds. So I was just wondering like what that's like.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad you brought that up. And you know, I thought of bringing other translations to it because, you know, translation is another piece of what I do, and I really, really love translation for the way that it continuously teaches me to use language with precision and power. Because by the time I've weighed like whether I'm going to translate brilla as shine, glisten, glimmer, gleams, radiates, all of those are sort of correct, which one do you choose? It's so much about context. You're going to lose something when you go along, but maybe you gain something on the other side. It's almost like an Andrew Jaron, who teaches in this program, has talked about, like, you get to see the language that you work in with a different clarity when you're like, it's almost like traveling to the moon and looking at the earth from the moon. Like, you get this other clarity on the language that you're working in. And for those of us who are bilingual and work in more than one language, that relationship, you know, I mean, I think some of the things that come up in translation are, of course, that there are things that don't have exact corollaries from one language to another. And then we ask ourselves whether we want to stay faithful to the literal or whether we want to try to recreate the meaning, the heart of what it was. And of course, translating my own poem, I had a lot more freedom because I could instantly ask the author if it was okay to make that kind of a change. Whereas when you're translating other people's work, you have to really weigh it and kind of if they had been working in English, would they have picked this word? So for example, this I had to write this in Spanish, as I said, and it starts, I think, a veces el inglés se esfuma. And for me, it had to be the word esfuma, but we can't say that in English. It's not the same, right? And so se esfuma, like it goes up in smoke. Right, it goes up in vapor, it like steams off, you know, and because it's smoke, but it could be vapor, and English just goes up in smoke. But I couldn't recreate that in one word in English, and because it was my own poem, I felt that I could take liberty to change the image, and so it became sometimes English collapses. Well, that's really different, mm-hmm. Right? It's like instead of having a little bit of water that goes up in vapor, it's a like a building that goes down into rubble. Very different image. But for me, it sort of captured the same concept, but already I'm changing it. You see what I mean? And so translation is kind of this beautiful and very artistic process of very lovingly doing that. The way I think of it is, my best way of thinking of translation is that it's almost like an act of transposing. If you know about in music, transposing a piece, like a classical work, like let's say Beethoven wrote a sonata for the piano, and you're transposing it to the violin. It's kind of like that. Like each language is like an instrument. There are things that the piano can do that the violin cannot do. And there are things that the violin cannot do that the piano can't do, right? And so at first it was in piano. Well, now the violin can have long notes, but it can't play chords the way a piano can. So we're now in a new instrument's realm, and we have to think, well, how would Beethoven have composed this if he'd been writing it for violin? I'm going to change it. I'm going to lengthen the notes. I think that keeps the spirit of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So when you have the richness of two or more languages, that's one thing I'll say, you know, is that you draw on the strengths and inherent beauty of each, and you're always weighing those decisions.
Just hearing you talk about translation, it made me wonder, how do you find translation coming into your own work, especially like, you know, you talk about method noveling. Do you find like translation is translation helps with that, or, you know, what is the correlation between translation and your work?
Well, it certainly helps me be able to read different languages for the research piece, right? Because in my case, there's so much that's in Spanish that's not in English. And also,
researching the Italian migration, I got a lot of books that were in Italian. That took me forever to sift through. But they were there, and they were helpful. But as far as my own, like the actual writing, yeah, you know, I mean, I write in English most of the time. English is my main, you know, this is because I was educated formally in English. And in my childhood, I never lived in a Spanish-speaking country. I was sort of born an immigrant. And so all of those hundreds of novels that I read, falling in love with reading and falling in love with writing, it, you know, it happened in English, and all of my schooling, my formal schooling, happened in English. And so the way I think of it for me is that English is the language of my intellect, and Spanish is the language of my bones. And it's deeper inside, which is maybe part of that thing that happened where something had to come out in Spanish. And so with the writing of the novel, the novels, there are times when I hear it in Spanish because the work that I'm doing is set in Argentina or set in Uruguay, and I know that the characters are speaking to each other. And also, some of you may know, Rio Platense Spanish, Argentinian Uruguayan is Rio Platense. Rio Platense Spanish is its own weird beast, right? We talk funny, you've maybe heard us talk, right? Like, we don't say, yo tengo la llave, we say, yo tengo la llave. You know, we don't say, siéntate, we say, sentate, bo. And so I hear it that way. You know, I hear people being like, sentate, bo, quiero pollo. You know, like, that's what I hear. And so sometimes I have to write it in Rio Platense Spanish first. And having the freedom to do that is great. And then I come back through later and bring the book into a language that people will be able to understand. Yeah. That more people will be able to understand. That, you know, that a monolingual person can enjoy. Yeah.
Thank you both.
Thank you.